From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, peering into the soul of leadership with the mind-body guru and mega best-selling author, Dr. Deepak Chopra. First, are America and the world on the brink of another oil crisis? Prices have already jumped up 40% this year and are swinging wildly with the turmoil in the Middle East, Iraq's shutoff, and political unrest in Venezuela. With warmer weather, American drivers are starting to hit the road again. Industry analysts warn a disruption in oil supplies could stunt economic recovery in the United States. Neela Banerjee covers the oil industry for the New York Times. She joins us now. Good evening and welcome, Neela Banerjee.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Neela, yesterday, Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein said that all Iraqi oil exports would be suspended for a month or until Israel withdrew unconditionally from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. What impact is this having, will it have, on oil prices and the U.S. economy?
Well, there's a confluence of things going on. As people told me yesterday, if it were just Iraq pulling its barrels off the market, that wouldn't be so bad.
Though Iraq is a very large oil supply and supplier.
Right. It can ship about 2.2 million barrels a day to the market. It's been shipping less, not so much for political reasons, but because of some issues with the UN. It's been shipping, I think, about 1.5 million barrels, and we get about half of that. We import about 780,000 barrels of Iraqi oil a day through third-party oil traders. That places them sixth as far as supply to the United States, but that's not so critical as the fact that there's problems in Venezuela, and we're entering a season when not only are we going to be driving more and flying more, but there are more SUVs on the road. We know that they don't get very good fuel efficiency, and last year there were more SUVs sold than cars in the United States. So it's a convergence of a lot of things that make this very worrying to a lot of people.
So when economists and oil analysts look out at this confluence of events, the tension and more than conflict in the Middle East, the roiling politics in Venezuela, the ever-mounting gasoline consumption, what possibilities does this raise?
Well, a lot of it depends on whether Saudi Arabia and other countries that have the spare capacity of their fields will step in and produce more. They have in the past, and they've said up till now that they're not going to participate in an embargo and that they would help consuming nations, mostly the United States, if there were any disruptions like what the Iraqis have proposed. The problem is that the Arab countries are under enormous pressure from their citizens not to look like they're at the beck and call of the United States because United States policy in the Middle East is so unpopular with most Arabs.
So in some ways, hitting the brakes on oil supplies might be easier than more radical steps like putting militaries into action.
Right, right. And it's not that they would go along with an Iraqi embargo. The question is, would they step up and increase supply? And right now, OPEC is taking a wait-and-see approach. And there is a lot of there's a lot of oil out there in inventories. Inventories of oil and products have been building in the United States, mainly of crude oil have been building in the United States. So that's a good sign. It's a good cushion.
How does Russia figure in, Neela Banerjee?
Russia can probably produce a little bit more, but really most of the spare capacity that can be brought online quickly is in Saudi Arabia. So that's what we're looking at, and that's who's helped the United States in the past when there have been disruptions by the Iraqis.
But presumably it will then be very plain that the Saudis are purposely stepping up and filling in the gap left by Iraq, which is sure not to be popular among Islamic opponents of what's going on in Israel and the West Bank.
Well, what they can do is, I mean, they don't necessarily have to come out and make a pronouncement, as they did after September 11th, for example, that they would keep oil supplies stable. They can do it rather quietly. Oil traders look for information from the Middle East about more tankers going into ports, more tankers than scheduled. And in about 4 to 6 weeks, we can see how much oil is coming from the Persian Gulf, because that's about how long it takes to make it to the U.S. and to refineries.
In his column today, Paul Krugman said in the New York Times, or alluded to, a third oil crisis. Mm-hmm. You talked about substantial reserves at the moment. How crisis-proof is the United States, the U.S. economy right now on the oil front?
Well, I think it's pretty crisis-proof. And what we've seen with the oil price is that there's a lot of volatility. Prices have swung up. They've swung back down. soothing words from OPEC and the Saudis have calmed the market today, but it really is dependent upon how long this lasts and whether the Saudis and others step in. That's the first thing. And the other thing, too, which people are losing sight of because of the violence in the Middle East, is what's happening in Venezuela. Venezuela is the third largest supplier of petroleum products and crude oil to the United States, and they're facing they're facing problems that could drag on for much longer in the standoff between President Chavez and a big swath of the population. And that unrest has come from the oil industry there.
And in the realm of relative vulnerability, how does the vulnerability of Europe and, I guess, Japan compare to that of the U.S. in oil supply terms?
Well, I think everybody's vulnerable, especially, you know, if they're not producer countries. And we do produce oil, and we do have allies in the Western Hemisphere, like Canada, Mexico, who aren't facing the same problems as Venezuela, or obviously are not in the political pressure that the Middle Eastern countries are under. And oil is a fungible quantity, but you have to remember that we as a country consume 25% of the world's crude oil every day. Our cars alone consume 10% of the world's crude oil every day. So we're terribly dependent on it as an economy and as a society.
Neela Banerjee, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Neela Banerjee covers the oil industry for the New York Times. Effective change in a family or a nation requires effective leadership. Without it, hard things get harder. There's a crisis of leadership in the world today, some say. Nobody is being spared the pain. Not the workers and shareholders bankrupted by greed at Enron. Not the children abused by their priests. And not Israelis and Palestinians caught in a downward spiral. Tonight, we're plunging headfirst into the leadership abyss with Dr. Deepak Chopra. He's written hugely popular books, including The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, that have changed the way millions of people think about the intersection of their spirit and their life. Now, Deepak Chopra's out to change the way we think about and choose our leaders. We've heard from the pundits, the professors, the politicians. Tonight, we're tuning in to a different wavelength. We're talking about leadership and the soul. In this age of change and disquiet, what do you need from your boss? Your president, who leads you? In your world, can anyone lead us together through the hurdles of the 21st century? And what's it going to take now to really lead? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Savannah, Georgia, is best-selling author and unabashed mind-body guru Deepak Chopra. Good evening, and welcome, Deepak Chopra. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a privilege. Thank you.
And with us in the studio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Deepak Chopra, we're accustomed to you instructing your army of followers on many fronts, everything from health and weight loss to sleeping well through the night to the search for God and satisfaction in love. Now, all of a sudden, you're out on leadership. What brought you to this topic?
Well, actually, I was invited to come and speak at Harvard Business School on this topic, on the soul of leadership. But I have thought about it for a long time. In fact, you know, one of my first experiences as a child was that when I was 10 years of age, Mr. Nehru, who was the heir to Mahatma Gandhi and the first Prime Minister of India, was coming to a small town where I lived, and I was only 10 years of age. And he was going to pass by our street. And my mother, who was very beautiful and about 28 years at that time, agonized for a week on what kind of sari she would wear when she went to see him, not realizing that there would be millions of people.
When we
arrived at the scene, there were literally tens of millions of people. As far as the eye could see, there was a sea of humanity. And as the motorcade came along, Mr. Nehru was standing in the Jeep, and, you know, in his characteristic Nehru jacket.
Sure.
And he had a rose in his jacket.
And as always.
Just as always. And just as the Jeep passed by us, he really looked into my mother's eyes and threw his rose. And it was, you know, even now, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, I remember the scene in slow motion. The crowd gasped. my mother stepped forward and picked up the rose like a queen, and the whole crowd went into a tumultuous applause. She brought the rose back to our home, and for the next 2 weeks, people would visit the house to look at the rose.
The Rose of Nehru.
The Rose of Nehru, which was in a sense the symbolic soul of India at that time. And the house would become totally silent. And you know, when the rose started to fade out in 2 weeks, then she took each petal and gave it to her special friends, who treasured it more than their most precious jewels. Now, what kind of leadership is that? And why don't we have it anymore?
Well, I guess we're here to ask you tonight. And, of course, you tend to bring things to this mind-body intersection. You always dwell on issues of the spirit. And when it comes to leadership, we hear you saying it's really not about where this line is on a map or where that barrel of oil flows. You say that the foundation of leadership is a spiritual quest. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, we have to define what spiritual quest really means and what spirit means. And in our society, you know, we kind of equate spirituality with self-righteous morality. We equate it with almost a forced morality, you know, where people have to have integrity, where they have to be truthful. And morality cannot be imposed. I think the best way to understand spirituality is that it is awareness. And the more expanded your awareness is, the more you can see yourself as part of the web of relationships that constitutes life, then the more contextually you see things, the more you're likely to have intuitive and creative and visionary and sacred responses instead of the fight, flight, or reactive response that we see amongst our leaders today. It doesn't matter where they are, but most leadership is really a function of fight, flight, or reactive ego responses. And the problem really is that our educational system does not nurture the psychological, emotional, and spiritual development of children or human beings, so that most studies show that the average male in most societies stops growing emotionally after the age of 14. And so you see that in the CEOs of major corporations who have 14-year-old egos in adult bodies, or you see that even in national leaders. I think the best way to understand spirituality and leadership is to recognize that both leaders and followers are actually part of a tangled hierarchy. They co-create each other. So the leader is the symbolic soul of the group, but in turn, the group represents the collective consciousness, and the group represents the aspirations and desires and the needs of the collective consciousness that are embodied in the leader. They're actually the same thing. You can't have a great leader if the collective awareness is basically needing only survival and safety, because that's going to evoke the fight-flight response.
Deepak Chopra, I want to bring Jack Beattie in here. Jack, Deepak Chopra is saying it's all a tangle. The led create the leader, and the leader creates or is in a tangle, is in a cycle with the led. If nobody can help us break out of that cycle, then we need some other kind of leadership, I guess.
Yes, you know, people call it the charismatic bond, the tie between the leader and the led. And Max Weber, who wrote about charisma in the West, talked about it as arriving in situations of mass distress. That is to say, the charismatic leader is in a certain sense the projection both of the distress and of the salvation from it, or the relief from it. And that the bond there is almost a kind of transference in psychoanalytic terms. And I think we saw it in this wonderful story about Nehru, how this rose took on, you know, sort of mystic properties, the hand that touched the hand. That's a hard kind of leadership to have. And of course, Nehru was one of the people who founded his country. Hard to reproduce that.
Hard to reproduce. We're talking tonight with Deepak Chopra. He's been thinking and writing lately about the soul of leadership. What do you need? What do you want from your leaders today, locally, nationally, in the world? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Deepak Chopra, super best-selling author of more than 30 books, including most recently The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. Deepak Chopra has given the world advice across a wide spectrum of topics on how to pull together the mind and body. He's a one-time Boston endocrinologist who spread out to look at alternative medicine and brought the soul right into the middle of things. His newest book is The Deeper Wound, Recovering the Soul from Fear and Suffering. Tonight, we're talking with Deepak Chopra about how his alternative view, his soul-based view, intersects with issues of leadership. And the question for you is, what are you looking for in a leader today? What kind of leader does the nation, does the world need to lead us out of the current turmoil that we see here and abroad? What kind of mind-body, mind-soul connection might put a leader in a better place to break through to a new vision of what the world can be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Deepak Chopra, when you look out at leadership around the world today, what do you see? Is there a vacuum there? If so, why?
There is a vacuum. You know, to understand leadership properly, you have to realize that in any group, people are looking, there are two basic themes in life that are being acted out. One is need, and the second is response. If we could see ourselves clearly, each of us would realize that every day there is something we need, ranging from the most primitive need for food and shelter to the higher needs of self-worth, love, spiritual meaning. Abraham Maslow described a hierarchy of needs. Similarly, there's a hierarchy of responses to fill those needs, ranging from struggle and competition to creative discovery and ultimately even divine inspiration. So as we see leaders through the world, from Castro to Tito to Gaddafi, Hussein, Milosevic, the robber barons and carpetbaggers of our societies, the terrorist movements and tyrannical regimes, you can see where they fit in this hierarchy. You know, those people are acting from fight-flight responses and serving in some way the desperate need of a group for survival and safety.
You write that leaders find true leadership not by looking out at the world necessarily exactly and assessing what's going on, but looking inward. This is not typically the way Americans think about leadership.
Well, you know, I think that we have to change that, because as long as a leader is thinking, how can I be a great leader, he's not going to be a great leader. If as long as a leader can think, what are the needs of the people that I serve? If it's achievement, if it's team building, belonging, is it nurturing, is it creativity, is it expression, is it spiritual growth, is it all of the above? And, you know, that kind of leadership really requires going inward and seeing your role in this web of relationships, and also having the ability to evoke responses that are not just triggered by situations and circumstances on a daily basis. You know, today's leader, in order to describe today's leader, you really, in a sense, have to describe all the things that this leader is contained in. You know, in order to describe a leader today, you have to understand that today's leader is contained in a field of activities ranging from terrorism to cell phones to biological warfare to antibiotics to anesthesia to polls to public opinion to advertising to media.
But these are the facts of life, aren't they, for any leader to swim through at least?
Well, the leader has to be aware of all these facts of life and say, how can I use this web of relationships that surrounds me to actually nurture the people that I serve, rather than being worried every day about, you know, what's happened today, how that has influenced, you know, public opinion about me. So the leadership cannot be short-term. If it's short-term, it's not going to be true leadership in the long run.
Jagpreet, Deepak Chopra wants leaders to quiet down, it sounds like, to look out at the world, but also to listen for deeper sources of inspiration. That's a tough challenge at the pace that things move these days.
It is, and especially, as you say, Americans feeling very uncomfortable with introspection. You know, when you think about leadership, I think about it in terms, really, of Spinoza, who said that freedom is the recognition of necessity. And I do think that's what leaders in some way do. They recognize necessity. And instead of the sort of voluntaristic idea of history, the sort of the hero in history who somehow masters events and changes them, that the real leader is the person who understands what must be and who orients his people to the evolving nature of reality. You know, and sometimes this is done clandestinely. I think the great example of leadership in the 20th century from an American president was Franklin Roosevelt in 1940-41, when in his short of war policy, he did everything he could to sustain Great Britain. He went right up to the verge of impeachment and perhaps beyond it through making executive agreements on his own, through cooking up deals, swaps for destroyers and the like. And he did it in a climate where the draft in 1940 was only sustained. Here's 1940. Hitler is in Paris, and our draft was only sustained by one vote, and that vote was sort of ginned up by the Speaker of the House. So he acted against what the public even seemed to want. And yet we look back and we said, that's what a great man does. He recognized the necessity that Nazism had to be defeated. And if American law was in the way of that, niceties of diplomacy and congressional hierarchy, he wasn't going to be bothered by that. He was going to risk his whole reputation, his presidency, on betting on Britain and then on the Soviet Union after June 1941. That, to me, is a great example of leadership.
I think Jack is absolutely, totally right on in this, and I couldn't agree with him more. You know, to risk your personal reputation in the moment and your popularity for the greater good is what makes a great leader. That's why we remember Roosevelt. That's why we remember Churchill. That's why we remember people like Nehru and many others that really had at their deepest intent the welfare of the people that they were serving and the needs, and had the appropriate responses to those needs so that they could move them to the next level of nurturing.
Let us ask you about a couple of more contemporary leaders. You write that a leader is the symbolic soul of the group. What symbolic soul did Bill Clinton represent? What symbolic soul does George W. Bush represent?
Achievement. You know, that the basic need is their ego. That it's the same category as a Bill Gates or Rupert Murdoch or Andrew Carnegie or Margaret Thatcher or Golda Meir or Indira Gandhi. These are very ambitious people that represent the need of society to achieve, and they promise achievement, and many times they're able to give it. On the other hand, FDR, Churchill, Nehru, Jack Welch or Sam Walton represent a slightly different kind of need response, where they're actually team building, they're giving inner direction to people. And then there are leaders like Florence Nightingale or Mikhail Gorbachev or Oscar Arias or Abraham Lincoln, who nurture their followers with a sense of self-worth. They have this intuitive feel that people want more than just achievement and belonging, that they want self-esteem and they want self-expression. There are creative leaders like Albert Einstein and Louis Pasteur and Walt Disney and Thomas Edison who serve the need for creativity and expression. Hmm. But, you know, remember, all these responses also have their shadow energy. So you can have, you know, with the great creative expressions of these leaders, you also have nuclear weapons and biological warfare and information hacking and internet debacles. So there are both sides to each of these responses.
We're looking at the soul of leadership tonight with Deepak Chopra. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. A lot of callers want to join. Let's turn to them. Rob is calling from Fairview, Pennsylvania. Hello, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing this evening?
Real well, Rob.
I want to say hello to you, Tom, and I want to say bless you to Deepak. And before we go any further, it's kind of ironic to me that leader sort of rhymes with greed. And how can we take, and I think that the masses of people are going to have to teach the leaders about greed. I don't think they're going to teach us, because through trying to reach all their achievement and trying to export violence, they're just showing to us that to be greedy. And I was wanted to ask Deepak how he thought we could possibly teach them not to be greedy.
Well, actually, it has to be a very fundamental shift in our educational system. I think we have to really teach leadership as a discipline in academia. We have to teach young people to look and listen and feel with their eyes and ears, but also with their mind and also with their soul, to have a vision, to look and listen and share with enthusiasm and inspiration and passion their vision with those that they lead. They should ask themselves, what's my motivation? Am I being selfish? Am I being of service? Am I trustworthy? They have to learn the principles of self-empowerment, but they also have to learn how to empower the people that they are leading. They have to have awareness. Who am I? What do I want? What's my purpose? They have to be action-oriented. And they have to learn how to actually think, not only analytically, not react all the time, but to really nurture their abilities that only we have as humans: intuition, creativity, vision, a sense of connection to the creative power of the universe, the ability to take responsibility. These are things that are not taught to young people, because we teach them everything about the world. We never teach them anything about themselves.
Deepak Chopra, that sounds like such a long list of ingredients, and at some level we all know that it's got to be there. On the other hand, we're trying to bring it down to the things we can understand and look for right now, maybe not a generation
out.
There's
no short-term solution. You know, I don't think there's any short-term solution that you're going to get a magical leader tomorrow. Right now, the world, the Islamic world, is in desperate need of a visionary leader. If the Islamic world could produce a Mahatma Gandhi equivalent, we would solve so many problems in the world.
I guess, Deepak Chopra, I don't personally believe that we're necessarily a generation away from discovering such a person among us, or that the Islamic nations are either, that our moral fiber is so worn that there's no one among us who could step up and have this vision. We see people who do show up with exactly the kind of spiritual depth and insight that you're describing at critical moments. I can't believe there's no one out there now.
That happens so sporadically and so rarely, because we have no way of, you know, we don't even have a system of education that goes into self-inquiry, mm-hmm. that goes into self-exploration, that goes into self-improvement. In fact, it's almost denigrated in our society.
Well, to Rob's point, and we thank you for your call, Rob, you write, Deepak Chopra, that the outcome of any situation is defined in advance by the vision that goes into solving it. If that's the case, then what will the outcome of the U.S. war on terror be, let's say?
It's a short-term outcome, you know. The U.S. war on terrorism is a good surgical excision of a tumor that has to be done, because it's so dangerous, the tumor. But if you don't ask yourself the deeper question, why did the tumor arise in the first place, then you're going to have a recurrence of the tumor. It's the same thing in medicine. You know, we constantly excise lesions in order to, because they are life-threatening. And this is a life-threatening, terrorism is an autoimmune disease of our civilization, which is life-threatening right now to our society. So we have to do a surgical operation. But if we think that's the solution, then we are misguided.
That's not the full extent of leadership. Sofian is on the line. Welcome, Sofian. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing, guys?
Well, thank you.
I agree with some points with Deepak Chopra and speaking as to be a neutral. I think the most basic things are for leaders is to be just, to treat his people with fairness and justice. and to be example. I think without going through deep philosophy, I think and I believe for a leader to succeed is to be just.
So justice is what you want to see. Do you see justice in leaders around you now?
I don't think so.
Deepak Chopra, thank you, Safiyan, for your call. Everyone would like to have a leader who's just. How do we know whether a leader is just?
I think justice is, a very one-sided perspective. What is justice on one side right now to the Palestinians is not justice to the Israelis. So ultimately, leadership really involves the ability to meet with the other side and say, what are you observing? What are you feeling? What are you needing? And how can I help you fulfill the needs? And you should ask me the same question. Hmm. But as I say, this is not going to happen tomorrow. You know, Tom, this is something, if we really want a new kind of leadership in the world, we have to take the best minds of our society and create an academic curriculum for leadership training, just like you train a physicist, or you train a mathematician, or you train a musician. Why can't we do the same, put the same effort on leadership, which is based on a true understanding of people's needs, how responses can fill those needs, and how the human soul, spirit, mind, whatever, mind-body continuum that we all have at our disposal can come up with creative solutions to our problems. But unless we put the best minds to create that academic curriculum, we need an institute of world leadership at no less a place than possibly Harvard.
Deepak Chopra, I know you're going to be speaking at Harvard on Friday at the Harvard Business School's Mobius Leadership Forum on Leadership, Values, and Spirituality. Let's take one more call before the break. Elizabeth is on the line. Welcome, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just had one comment, and that is that when Mr. Chopra spoke about the fight-or-flight paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Duke's up or out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think there's been some research done recently that found that there's a totally different response to stress that women have, which is to tend to nurture and bond with others in the face of stress. And I wonder if he would comment on that. I know that obviously all women leaders are not automatically nurturers, but I'm wondering if we're looking for a more feminization of leadership.
That's a great point, Elizabeth. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
That's a very good comment and a question, but our women leaders, like most of them, actually have been more fight-flight oriented than even the men. We look at Indira Gandhi and Golda Meir and Mrs. Bandaranaike. They were pretty powerful.
Isn't that counterintuitive?
It is, because they were competing in a man's world. So I think that the lady is right, that women do have the ability to be more contextual, relational, holistic, nurturing, wise, and not necessarily have a win-lose orientation. But we have kind of deprived women of that because we've asked them to compete with ourselves in our ways of fight-flight. So, you know, the emergence of feminism we have seen is actually a very strident, competitive feminism. On the other hand, there are traditions, particularly in India, where they have goddess cultures, where the feminine face of God, Shakti, or the Hebrew word is Shekinah, is worshipped, and where this nurturing quality is actually fostered and cultured, not only in women, but also in men.
Deepak Chopra, stand by. We're talking tonight about the soul of leadership with Deepak Chopra. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What are you longing for in leaders in leadership today? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with mind-body guru Deepak Chopra about the new challenges of leadership in the 21st century, about the soul of leadership. Deepak Chopra says, if it's not connected to the soul, it's not leadership. What are you looking for in leader today? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beattie. Deepak Chopra is talking about the challenge or the task of a generation in educating people ready to be leaders.
Yeah, I'm a little uneasy with the cult of leadership in a democracy. You know, when you look at great leaders in history, they tend to be dictators. Or, you know, from Napoleon to Lenin to Hitler and so on, we have situational leaders, people with situational charisma in democracies like Winston Churchill, like Franklin Roosevelt. But you know, the task of the democratic leader is really to find consensus. And not to necessarily, you know, if we look to leaders to save us, we're really giving up on our own citizenship. Eugene Victor Debs, the American radical and socialist candidate for president in 1912, said, "If I can lead you into the promised land, then somebody else can lead you out." And that's the cult of the leader. And he was saying, look, I don't want any part of that. You're going to go into the promised land, not because I led you, but because you as citizens decided to. And I think there's a strain. You know, we all want the salvific leader, but in democracy, we need consensus, first of all, and that binds a leader. George Bush now, that was a 50-50 election. He's got to watch the limit of his consensus. When he appoints somebody to the Supreme Court who's too radical, he's not going to get that because that consensus isn't there. He has to respect that limit on his leadership.
Deepak Chopra, how about that? How does consensus coexist with leadership?
Right. He's absolutely right. In a democracy, the leader does represent the collective consciousness, the collective aspirations, the collective desires. So he's absolutely, totally right. But sometimes the situation and also creates a visionary leader, a Mother Teresa, a Martin Luther King, a Mahatma Gandhi, a Nelson Mandela, a Dalai Lama. These are great leaders that have also come out of crisis, of in situations of poverty and impoverishment, in the midst of torture. So the fact is that the leader is indeed the symbolic expression of what is required and needed in society at that moment. And it's a mirage to think that a leader is a cult leader. You know, the cult leader is created by the cult. It isn't that the cult leader creates a cult. It's a tangled hierarchy, as usual. They both co-create each other. They serve each other's addictions, if you will, or needs.
Tony's on the line. Welcome, Tony. You're on the air.
Hey.
Good evening.
I'm actually one of the Harvard Business School students that's organizing the Mobius Leadership Forum at the end of this weekend.
Oh, great. Thanks for calling in, Tony.
Yeah, sure.
That's Friday at Harvard Business School.
Yeah,
this is a conference
Friday
on leadership, values, and spirituality. This is not something we associate the spirituality part with Harvard Business School necessarily.
I know. And in the business school, we're actually taught all about like maximizing shareholder value. And to that extent, you know, only when values and spirituality can bring better like financial returns, then it's great. But sometimes the market doesn't value it. And one example is Anita Roddick, who resigned as chairman of the Body Shop earlier this year. Mm-hmm. When she resigned, the stock went up. And so my question for Mr. Chopra, Dr. Chopra, is that, why should we act on spirituality and values in business, if you're a business person, when it doesn't maximize returns?
Actually, in the long term, it will. You know, I know in business school, the first thing that's taught is the purpose of a business is to maximize return, to make profit. But, you know, that's not really the purpose of a business. The purpose of a business is to serve the needs of society. And if you keep that in mind, then in the long term, profit will be the bottom line. You know, there are, in fact, many studies that show that for a business to be really successful, it needs loyalty from three constituencies. It needs loyalty from employees. It needs loyalty from customers. It needs loyalty from stockholders. And if you look at these three constituencies, you find that of these three, the most important is employees. And studies show that employees are looking for more than just salaries. They're looking for a sense of belonging, self-worth, self-esteem, nurturing, growth, and all the things that we aspire as spiritual beings, as human beings. You know, we have needs more than just simply material needs.
But Deepak Chopra, in an economy where quarterly returns are so closely scrutinized, does this preclude spiritual leadership in business?
Well, you know, when I look at the economy and the stock market, I get the feeling that it's is the patient people making money off the impatient people. And the patient people will always invest in companies that have values, that serve society, that do good business, and that nurture their employees and their customers. And in the long run, it is those patient people who will make money off the impatient people.
Tony, thanks for your call. Bobby is on the line. Welcome, Bobby. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask if we are preparing the kind of leaders, and say that it will take us a generation, since in a democracy we sort of choose our own leaders, mm-hmm. don't we also have to think about educating ourselves so that we are willing to accept the kind of leadership that we're trying to nurture? And I guess I'm saying if we want leaders who listen to others, who try to reach a just and fair solution, then we need to be able to accept that as a goal rather than wanting leaders who will meet our own needs and fulfill our own goals.
You mean, are we prepared for just leadership?
Yes.
Ooh, that's a big question. Thank you, Bobby, for asking it. Deepak Chopra.
I think when a critical mass of people has the intention and the desire that that's what we want for ourselves, then we will create the systems that will nurture and foster the emergence of those kinds of leaders. But she's absolutely right. Till we are ready for that ourselves, we're not going to have either the desire to educate those kinds of leaders, or we're not even going to see the emergence of those kinds of leaders. We have to be at a certain stage of development ourselves.
Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello. What Hi. A beautiful program. Thank you so much.
Glad to do it.
I believe that the wave of the future for leadership has already been shown us by Gandhi and by Martin Luther King. Now, he was a humble preacher, Martin mm-hmm. Luther, and he grew into it because of the movement of the people. It was very democratic, I felt, and I worked for that civil rights movement, mm-hmm. of course, and so I just would like him to speak a little more about how it happens, if he can. And I thank you for the whole thing. You've really answered the question for us, and thank
well,
you.
Well, thank you, sir. I never had the privilege of knowing Martin Luther King, but I did have the privilege of spending a long time talking to Rosa Parks. And I questioned her in detail about, you know, what was happening in her inner world when she refused to give up her seat on that bus on that fateful day in Montgomery, Alabama. And what came through clearly was that she was, in her elegant simplicity, she was not concerned about what people thought of her. She was immune to criticism. She was totally fearless. And she had a simple intent that she was not going to succumb to injustice. And in her simplicity, she started a movement that never stopped.
Deepak Chopra, you write that being comfortable with disorder is a necessary characteristic of a great leader. Yet this is a time when people are hungry for order. Another contradiction?
In a sense, you know, disorder and ambiguity and chaos and confusion is a very fertile ground for creativity. When there is complete order, there is complacency, mm-hmm. and leadership really stagnates in those times. You see, even now recently, we see the emergence of great leadership qualities in Mr. George Bush as a result of the chaos and disorder that we saw.
Would you say so? Does he stack up to your standard?
He doesn't stack up to my standard, but he certainly stacks up to a lot more than I thought him capable of.
Mm-hmm. So disorder, meaning in the eyes of an effective leader, is a state of opportunity.
Is a setting for creativity, yes. Creativity requires the proliferation of disorder and ambiguity.
Deepak Chopra, when I look at the whole spectrum of things that you're ready to require, it almost sounds like a leader has to be a Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King.
Well, why not? Why not stretch for the highest? Why not have our, you know, stretch greater than our reach? I mean, what's that phrase that people like to say, you know, if your stretch is not greater than your reach, then what's a dream for?
Mm.
You know, if you plan to go 100 miles, why not plan to go 1,000,000 miles? Then you might get to 100 miles.
Of course, the trouble today is we have a corrosive media culture that would expose, for example, Gandhi's very peculiar habits in regard to sleeping with young women to test his virtue. And, of course, Martin Luther King's own similar problems. And all this would become public. I mean,
I know,
it works against, doesn't it?
Jack, but you see, that's so irrelevant, you know.
I agree.
Till the 9/11 tragedies occurred, the whole nation was obsessed with Gary Condit.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, that's the triviality of our attention.
I understand, but to recognize the leader, you got to push it. The media is going to tell you about all the triviality.
I know, and then we're going to get caught up in it and lose the big picture.
Yeah.
Jack, Deepak Chopra, thanks so much for being with us tonight. It's been a pleasure to have you.
It was a pleasure to be with you, and grateful to be with Jack, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Deepak Chopra will be speaking this Friday at Harvard Business School's Mobius Leadership Forum Conference on Leadership, Values, and Spirituality. His newest book is The Deeper Wound, Recovering the Soul from Fear and Suffering. For more information on Deepak Chopra, including how to view his Harvard Business School lecture online, go to our website, log on to onpointradio.org. In a moment, observing Holocaust Memorial Day while violence plagues the Middle East. This is On Point.
Mouthfield Hamburger, Pauline Hamburger, Rosa Hamburger, Teresa Hamburger, Lippy Hammer, Nettie Hamburger.
Near the bustling traffic of Commonwealth Avenue, one of Boston's busiest streets, two college students sat in a windy courtyard earlier this evening as part of a 24-hour reading of the names of Jewish victims of the Holocaust.
Elizabeth Hammer, Webb Hammer, Martha Hammer, Israel Hammerlip, Nettie Hammerman, Alice Hammer.
The reading was one of many events around the world marking Yom HaShoah. Or Holocaust Memorial Day. In Washington, members of Congress and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice joined Nobel laughureate and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel for a service in the Capitol Rotunda. And in Israel, much of the country came to a standstill for 2 minutes of silence at 10 a.m. local time. Jack Beatty, you hear that list of names, and we know that that roll call of victims of the Holocaust and Hitler's Nazi era rolls behind so much of what goes on in the Middle East these days and always.
It does indeed. Today, the Israelis had their heaviest blow since this uprising began 18 months ago, losing 13 soldiers. Prime Minister Sharon said it was a difficult day. Difficult indeed. You know, Israel represents sort of the, for our history, that is Western history, the survival of Israel is the only thing that gives even the shadow of meaning, I won't dare say redemption, to the Holocaust. That is to say, all of Christian Europe went into the making of the Holocaust. And Israel, which is the state that will protect the Jews, we all have an investment in making it work. It's about Western history. And it's just so tragic that Israel should now be getting the Muslim world, having been sort of put there as a result of the Christian world's failures, and now having the backlash from the Muslim world. But the West owes Israel, I think, the moral obligation to the survival of that people and that state is absolute.
And yet, we see that obligation being played out on ground that is not in Germany or the Netherlands or France.
That's true. That's
it's
true.
It's in the Levant.
That's
It is in the Arab world, or what's been for centuries the Arab world. And there, wow, what a clash ensues.
Yes. Amos Alon, the Israeli writer, says that he gave his image of the founding of the settlement of Israel after the war. He said, you know, it's like a man jumps out of a burning building and he lands on somebody else. Well, the burning building was the Holocaust. The Jews jumped out and they landed on the Palestinian. It's a tragedy. And both peoples need to find a way. And yet, you know, as you read about Israeli society, the people want it. 66% of the people are still in favor of a two-state solution on 1967 borders. Quite a statement.
Everyone brings a story to that conflict. Tonight we remember the victims of the Holocaust. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This has been On Point.